Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where history sets out to conquer all. The podcast where truth takes centre stage and myth is exiled off to St. Helena and surrounded with poisonous wallpaper. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I am manning this redoubt alone today as we're recording earlier just to accommodate the time difference with today's guest. Now on to today's guest. If you joined us for last week's rage about piracy, well, we're jumping forward in time this week to the 19th century, but you will be pleased to know that it's an age of just as extreme hats. This week, dear ragers, we are joined by historian and host of the Generals and Napoleon podcast, John Viscardo. John, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the show and can't wait to rage.
Excellent. Feeling angry?
Oh yeah, always.
Good, good. So, you come here before us today at your own request, if I recall correctly, because you contacted us to get a few things off your chest.
That's right.
De facto therapists of the history world as we are, we're only too happy to oblige. But before I start, would you tell us a little bit about your background, your interest, and the podcast that you are the host of?
Sure. Well, quite simply, my podcast, Generals and Napoleon, is on the greatest collection of military talent in history on both sides. If you think about some of the names that came out of the era, Napoleon, Duke of Wellington, Marshal Davout, Marshal Blücher, Archduke Charles of Austria, Marshal Ney, I think almost everyone in the world knows Napoleon, but I wanted to learn about the other actors in the Greek tragedy that is the story of Napoleon. So that's, in a nutshell, what my podcast is about. Not so much about Napoleon, the man himself, but more about his subordinates, and the generals that opposed him.
Okay, and how long have you been going?
Oh my, since June of 2022, and we are on, I think, 57 episodes now, and still going strong.
Still going strong. And I know you've had a couple of our previous History Ragers on your show, Marcus Cribb, who'd also recommended that I get in touch with you, and Zach White as well.
Yeah. We've had some really fantastic guests. We had actor Cary Elwes from The Princess Bride. He did an episode on General Gudin. We've had Alexander Mikhailovich. He's done several Russian generals. So it's been a real, I guess, eclectic group of guests on my podcast, and I'm thrilled to be on yours.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you. Do my ego the world of good. I may, in fact, try and get on yours at some point as well, but my knowledge of Napoleonic generals is less than my knowledge of 19th century dueling.
Oh, all right.
And, well, I have a history rage in there of my own, which I may come to your podcast to do.
Anytime. Open invitation. Thanks, Paul.
So let's kick off today's rage then. So would you please tell our French column of history ragers out there what is the one thing that you wish everyone would just stop believing or get over?
I would wish and want that all historians and Bonapartists and fans of Napoleon believing that he did everything by himself, that he just showed up on a battlefield with his brilliance and outwitted his dumb opponents, and that his marshals were bumbling fools. That briefly is it. Would you like me to go into detail?
Yes, certainly expand on that. Yeah.
All right. Very talented man, obviously. Napoleon, one of the best generals of all time, but you know, the people he was up against, they were not, you know, bad generals. His opponents had decades of military experience, whether it was the Austrians, the Prussians, the British, the Russians, or the Spanish. Napoleon and his generals defeated some very talented men. Archduke Charles of the Austrian army was considered one of the best tacticians in Europe, and he lost to Napoleon 6 times. But he was still a smart man and had beaten several French generals and marshals previous to coming up against Napoleon. Marshal Blücher was one of the most inspirational leaders in the Prussian army, and he lost to Napoleon on 5 different occasions. I will say that Napoleon usually outworked his adversaries and his marshals, staying up for hours and sometimes days at a time to figure out how to win his next battle. But his generals and marshals were very, very talented men.
Okay, so before we get into the specifics of who they are, one thing I don't know, because I'm not, you know, Napoleonic historian by any stretch of the imagination. So can you tell us a bit about that hierarchy and the command structure of the Grand Army of Napoleon? Where the generals sit in this, their role, their responsibilities, how much influence they can wield over any potential outcome?
Sure thing. Well, if you don't mind, I'll kind of expand it a little bit. I'll just do the hierarchy of the whole French Empire of Napoleon and just kind of whittle it down to...
Brilliant.
Okay. So at the top, obviously, was Napoleon and his royal family. His wife, Josephine, the jury is still out on whether she was helpful or hurtful to his empire. He did have some loyal and talented stepchildren in his stepdaughter, Hortense, and Prince Eugene, who was a very able commander in the Grand Armée. Also in this top echelon were his disloyal and incompetent siblings. That would be King Joseph of Spain, King Louis of Holland, and King Jerome of Westphalia. And then Napoleon had a few sisters who were princesses, or in Caroline's case, the Queen of Naples, because of her marriage to Marshal Murat. Mm-hmm. All of these people owed their kingdoms to Napoleon. Below this group were the marshals. There was 26 of them in total. They weren't all marshals from day one. Kind of Napoleon awarded them as they earned, you know, battlefield merit or what have you. Some were brilliant, some not so much, but all were fearless, and all but one had navigated the chaotic times of the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And your historians and your following, you know, they may know that obviously the French Revolution was a dangerous time and generals were losing their heads for losing a battle or not being patriotic enough. The only marshal who wasn't in Paris or in France at this time was Marshal Poniatowski of Poland, but we'll get to him. Napoleon utilized these marshals as something akin to warlords or viceroys in his ever-expanding kingdom. Napoleon was a smart guy, and he knew he couldn't be everywhere at once, so he would dispatch these marshals across his vast empire to do his bidding. Mm-hmm. Some of these marshals had natural talent for administration, like Marmont or Bernadotte. Others, like Soult and Massena, just looted their conquered territories for every penny they had. When on the battlefield, Napoleon would lay out his overall battle plans to his marshals and then disseminate his orders through his genius chief of staff, Marshal Berthier, who should get more credit for Napoleon's empire. He was the logistical genius who made Napoleon's dreams a reality. And he would also take Napoleon's complex tactics, make them easily understood for the other marshals and generals in the field. Moving on from there, regarding operational tactics, Napoleon usually left the handling of his battle to his corps commanders. For instance, Napoleon would say, "General Paul, you need to take that position or castle or city by a certain time, but it was up to you, General Paul, as the corps commander, to figure out how to do that."
Yeah.
Maybe it was a direct assault, maybe a flanking attack, maybe a double envelopment, but they had to get it done by a certain time or they would be sacked. As the marshals in Spain found out, Napoleon didn't put up with subpar performances for long. So whittling it down from there, below a marshal, basically a corps commander, it could be a marshal, without getting too deep into platoons and regiments and all that stuff. The main tactical units of the Grand Armée was a corps, which was made up by a few divisions of troops. A division consists of 5,000 to 10,000 men. Divisions were commanded by, you guessed it, a general of division.
Yeah.
So several divisions were assigned to a marshal, and each corps had its own infantry, cavalry, artillery, and was expected to fight on its own for 24 hours, no matter how big the opponent was. By that time, Napoleon could usually bring up his other corps, who were all usually within a day's march, to crush the enemy. It was a very good system until his opponents started to figure it out.
With apologies to Sam Jolly, who I know is an absolute Napoleon fan out there. Hello, Sam. But I do love to dump on Napoleon here. So, Zach Loyalists, you could be in for a treat here. But can you tell us about a few examples where Napoleon is actually outshone by these generals then? Because it does sound like the grand victories belong to them more than him, because he's left them free to plan how to do it.
Of course. And of course, shout out to Sam Jolly. Indeed, I can, though. Several times, Napoleon's generals and marshals saved his bacon. I'll give you a few instances here. In 1800, at the Battle of Marengo, which pretty much secured his throne, Napoleon had gone famously over the Alps on a donkey and came into Italy in search of the Austrians who were attacking his possessions there. He, for whatever reason, split his army apart in search of the Austrians. While he was doing this, he was surprised and attacked by a large Austrian force under General Melas, and Napoleon had to urgently recall General Desaix's 6,000 troops, who thankfully marched to the cannon fire and turned a probable loss for Napoleon into an amazing victory. And there's a story that goes, when Desaix was asked by Napoleon what he thought of the situation, General Desaix replied, quote, "This battle is completely lost. However, there is time to win another," end quote. So basically, those extra 6,000 troops saved Napoleon from a probable defeat and might have cost him his throne at an early time in the empire. Unfortunately, it cost General Desaix his life, who probably would have been made marshal had he survived. In 1806, we have a great example. Napoleon and his war against Prussia had marched towards the Prussian army, but misjudged which Prussian force he was facing. He thought he was facing the main portion of the Prussian army at Jena, and had unwisely sent off Marshals Davout and Bernadotte on a wide flanking march around this force. But as Marshal Davout found out at Auerstadt, a town a little farther away, he was the one facing the main Prussian army. And with only 20,000 troops, Marshal Davout improbably defeated a Prussian force three times his size.
Wow.
Yeah, so in that case, Marshal Davout's efforts really helped seal Napoleon's victory over Prussia in that war.
So how does he go about doing that?
Yeah, great question. So Marshal Davout is known as the Iron Marshal because he rigidly and ferociously trained his troops, and he made sure that they always had everything they needed, horses, food, ammunition. And he had three really good divisional generals under him who withstood this brutal attack from the Prussians for several hours. Like I said, 60,000 going against 20,000. He used the ground wisely at Auerstadt to repel this Prussian force for hours. And then when they were totally worn down, surprisingly, he attacked the Prussian force, who was shocked that such a small force would do that, and made them flee into the woods. So it was said that Napoleon fought a battle at Jena that he couldn't lose, and Marshal Davout fought a battle at Auerstadt that he couldn't win, and both commanders were victorious. So that was just an amazing victory by Marshal Davout.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd never heard of that one as well, because you think then that, you know, Battle of Jena, Napoleon victory, move along.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, okay, just another Napoleon victory. But the Auerstadt one is really incredible. There's another one in 1807 against Russia. This one, I would say, of all the ones I'm going to mention, is the one that really saved Napoleon's bacon. They were marching in awful weather, in a blinding snowstorm against the Russians at the Battle of Eylau. And Napoleon made a tactical mistake, ordering Marshal Augereau to attack the Russians in a blinding snowstorm. Well, of course, Augereau's corps got lost and blundered into the front of the Russian artillery battery, who just, you know, tore it to pieces and unloaded on them. Then the Russians made an assault on the French center, which almost captured Napoleon and punched a hole in his lines. Thankfully, Marshal Murat made one of the most amazing cavalry charges in history, launching 10,000 mounted troopers against the Austrians, which turned, again, a certain defeat into somewhat of a pyrrhic victory, as the Russians withdrew from the battlefield. Yeah, that one's incredible. That's probably the most epic cavalry charge of all time.
And we could, I suppose, had that gone the other way, as you mentioned, they blow most of the French army away and almost capture Napoleon. That could have been the end of the entire Napoleonic period there, were it not for this one guy that's getting completely overshadowed.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many of those where Napoleon probably should have lost, or probably should have been captured, but one of his generals or marshals did something amazing. In 1809, over the victory against the Austrians at Wagram could also be accredited to the actions of his marshals. Marshal Massena somehow directed his corps from a coach driven around the battlefield by a team of horses. So imagine a guy laid up with his foot in a bandage, directing from his coach you know. I know. And that was just cannon fodder for the opposing armies. They were trying to blow up his coach while he was directing the army. But also in that battle, Generals MacDonald, Marmont, and Oudinot performed so well that day that they all earned marshal's batons after the battle. In 1812, this is probably, it was a joke that Napoleon must have made a deal with the devil to get out of Russia. And I'd argue that the subordinates actually outshine the emperor in terms of performance in Russia.
Yeah.
Marshal Ney, Davout, and Murat were pivotal in defeating the Russians at Borodino outside of Moscow, while Napoleon was sick and under the weather, and he was a mile away from the battlefield. Really almost had no control over the battle. He let his marshals handle that one. And then during the retreat, when Napoleon's force was starving and lacking equipment, his supporting marshals, Victor and Oudinot, somehow found the emperor and his dwindling force in terrible weather with atrocious roads. And Marshal Oudinot also found the vital ford over the Berezina River, which allowed Napoleon's troops to escape Russia. And through it all, the great, my favorite marshal, Marshal Ney, fought his famously stubborn rear guard, which prevented the Russians from destroying Napoleon's force.
I mean, Napoleon gets away by the skin of his teeth. Again.
Yes. Again, right.
Again.
And there's more. I mean, I could go on, but those are really the big ones.
Yeah. Well, we may come back to a few of those. Thank you. So you mentioned a few instances there where, like, Napoleon's ill, he's got no real control. And you mentioned earlier on at the start as well that Napoleon recognizes he can't be everywhere at once, even though grand dictators might like to micromanage everything that's going on.
Right.
How do his generals compare when Napoleon's not around? What are their records like independent of Napoleon?
Good question. First, I must say that the marshals and generals generally performed better when Napoleon was around. Reason being, there was a clear vision of the objectives with one person, Napoleon, making decisions. That said, several of the marshals had winning battle records without Napoleon anywhere around. Mm-hmm. And I guess before we get into battle records, we should define what a victory is and what a loss is.
Yeah, yeah.
In my mind, to put simply, a victory is when one general or marshal defeats the opponent and takes an objective, which could be a battlefield, a city, or a stronghold like a castle. A loss is when a general or marshal must retreat or surrender a position. Mm-hmm. Using those metrics, Marshal Bernadotte had a stellar record of 13 wins and only 3 losses. Marshal Saint-Cyr, 14 wins and only 4 losses. Marshal Suchet had 15 wins and only 5 losses. Marshal Davout, who we discussed earlier, the Iron Marshal, was said to be undefeated. And even Marshal Soult, who had a subpar record of 17 wins and 22 losses, was considered an above-average general because most of those losses occurred against one of the top 10 generals of all time in the Duke of Wellington. So to sum up, most of the marshals performed well when Napoleon was nowhere near them, and they should get more credit for the success and longevity of Napoleon's empire.
So do you want to tell us about a few of those wins?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Saint-Cyr, he was a really smart guy, but very stoic and very, he didn't like working with the other marshals very much, but he won a major battle in Russia, Polotsk. And then he also helped Napoleon win a major victory at Dresden in 1813. Really smart guy and very talented. Marshal Suchet had most of his victories in Spain, where a lot of the other marshals had terrific trouble winning any battles of any kind. And Marshal Suchet really took good care of his troops. He had good hospital services. He didn't loot from the local populace. And I think that is what gave him a lot of his victories. He just knew how to administrate his territories and fight smart wins that got him to that lofty position.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, so we're going from the victories then to the disasters. Two of the biggest disasters in the Napoleonic Wars, at least for France, in my opinion, would be the invasion of Russia. I won't go into Russian winter, but the invasion of Russia and the Battle of Waterloo. Now, how much of those disasters would be down to Napoleon and overreach and ambition, and how much of it is down to those he actually tasked with executing a strategy?
Yes, both of those disasters, Russia and Waterloo, in my mind, sit entirely on Napoleon's shoulders. I don't like it when Bonapartists or historians tried to blame the marshals for either of those. In my mind, that's kind of like blaming an assistant coach for the loss of your favorite soccer team or football team. You know, the buck stops at the top.
Yeah.
Napoleon made the decision to attack Russia. He also made the decision to attack the Allies in Belgium in 1815. Now, that being said, could some of the subordinates done better in both? Absolutely. You know, in Russia, for whatever reason, he made probably his least capable brother, Jerome, commanders of one of the wings of his army. Well, Jerome performed very badly. He didn't want to be there. You know, he was a pleasure-loving guy. He didn't really want to be at the front lines where, you know, he was fighting a battle. So he got an argument with his brother and, of course, left the army basically a month or two after they got into Russia. Once in Russia, though, I would say most of his generals and marshals performed as well as they could have. You have to realize these guys were, even the marshals and generals were starving, you know, and they were not immune to the weather either. So whether it was disease or starvation or, you know, just dying of, you know, freezing cold weather, a lot of the marshals suffered terribly in Russia, and so did their performance, for that matter. At Waterloo, that one, you can make a case that the marshals didn't do a great job. Marshal Soult was assigned to be the chief of staff for Napoleon. Marshal Berthier, his genius chief of staff, had died of mysterious circumstances on June 1st. Yeah, do you know that story?
I don't. Do tell.
All right. So Napoleon comes back from Elba, as everyone knows. He reclaims his throne. Some marshals rally to his flag and like, oh, great, you're back. And then some others retreat with King Louis XVIII, you know, over the border to escape Napoleon. One of those who escorts King Louis over the border is Marshal Berthier, his chief of staff. Now, once the king's safely across France over the border, Marshal Berthier has a decision to make. Should I stay with my loyalties and stay loyal to the King of France, or should I go support my old master, Napoleon? And allegedly, he's in some town, I think somewhere in Germany or not very far from France, and he sees a column of Russian troops marching towards France to help Wellington and the Prussians fight the Battle of Waterloo. Well, Berthier sees this from like a fifth floor balcony and either by accident or deliberate suicide falls off that balcony and kills himself. So, you know, basically Napoleon's right-hand man dies right before the biggest battle of 1815.
Yeah.
So to replace him, he hires Marshal Soult, a very smart guy, but really not a chief of staff type of person. Famously during the battle, Napoleon sends a messenger. He wants a message sent to Marshal Grouchy, who's far away on the right wing fighting the Battle of Wavre. He's supposed to be handling the Prussians so Napoleon can focus on the British. And so Napoleon sends this message off and he says, Marshal Soult, did you send that message off? And Soult's like, of course, I sent one rider. And Napoleon says, one rider? Berthier would have sent six. You got to make sure that message gets across. So little things like that, Marshal Soult wasn't the most adept at handling. On the other side of that, Marshal Ney, who was leading the attack against the British, great inspirational leader, not the best tactician, but he fought a really good battle that day. I think he gets too much criticism for how that battle turned out. In fact, Marshal Ney, in my opinion, was winning it briefly when he captured La Haye Sainte and was destroying British squares with cannon fire. However, he didn't have full control of Napoleon's army. The Imperial Guard was held by Napoleon and wasn't released till the very end when it was too late. Marshal Grouchy was off fighting the Prussians in Wavre, so it wasn't the most coherent of battles fought by Napoleon. There's a famous memoir by General Marbot who says the French army maneuvered like pumpkins that day, whatever that means. So, yeah, I mean, could the marshals have done better? Yeah, sure, but again, you know, the buck stops at the top. Napoleon was in charge of that battle. If the Duke of Wellington had lost the battle, would we have placed blame on Picton or, you know, General Hill? Probably not. It would have been, you know, the Duke of Wellington lost the battle. Yeah. But because he's Napoleon, you know, it can't be him. He's a genius. How could he lose a battle? So people just look for other people to blame. And unfortunately, that falls on the generals or marshals.
So one of the things that Zach brought up when he did a really quite impressive rage about Napoleon himself was this idea that Grouchy going to the Prussians isn't fast enough. Well, what's your take on that?
Napoleon gave him strict orders to go to this town called Wavre, engage the Prussians there. Now, he was supposed to hold them there without aiding Wellington at Waterloo, you know, but his written instructions were to attack the Prussians at Wavre. It wasn't to ignore my orders and march to the sound of the cannon, you know. So he was doing his job. He beat the Prussians at Wavre. He wisely extricated his troops and got them back to Paris in case Napoleon wanted to have another roll of the dice. So to lay blame at Grouchy's feet, I don't like that either. I think he followed his instructions to the letter and did a good job.
Yeah, I suppose if Napoleon, like you say at the start, is going to be going, right, you need to do that, I'll let you work out how to do it, but that and only that is what you need to be doing.
Correct.
Grouchy's done that, hasn't it?
Yeah, he has. And Napoleon didn't, I mean, he liked some initiative, but he didn't like when people ignored orders, obviously, as any general doesn't. So to say that Grouchy should have just, you know, torn up his orders and marched to Napoleon to save the day. Yeah, I don't agree with that.
Okay, so Waterloo spells the end, really. Well, I would say actually possibly the end was dealt out way before Waterloo, but Waterloo is the final full stop at the bottom of the exclamation mark there. What do the remaining generals do after Waterloo and the end of Napoleon? Do any of them really play a part in the downfall of Napoleon?
Yeah, a few do, unfortunately.
Oh, we're going to like this. Come on, man.
I know. The juicy part, right?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. Now, again, all these marshals and generals, yeah, they served France and they did a lot to help their country. But towards the end of the Napoleonic Empire, like, they could see that France was going down and Napoleon was going down with them. They could see the writing on the wall, except for Napoleon. So, in January of 1814, Marshal Murat, who was sitting on the throne of Naples in Italy, decides, you know what? Keeping my throne is more important than staying loyal to Napoleon. So he switches sides. The Allies guarantee he'll keep his throne. So he attacks Prince Eugene's troops in Italy. And Napoleon can't believe it because he's known that guy for 20 years and that he's turning sides along with Napoleon's sister, Caroline, are just, you know, turning sides against the man who gave them everything is just unbelievable to most me, historians, and probably all of France. But worse than that, there is a guy named Marshal Marmont who is supposed to be defending Paris in addition to Marshals Monse and Mortier and a few other marshals, while Napoleon is out in the field attacking the Allies from behind. For whatever reason, Marmont says, you know what? I'm just going to surrender Paris. France has seen enough war, and I'm going to make a separate peace treaty with the Allies. Now, Marshal Marmont's name is now basically the same thing in France as the word to betray. His title was Duke of Ragusa. So to be a Raguser now is to betray someone. And he's like the Benedict Arnold of France. He makes a separate peace treaty with the Allies, and basically his name is smeared through the mud ever since then. Even after that, he's called again to Paris in 1830 to put down a popular revolt. It's called the July Revolution against the Bourbons. Hmm. He fails to do this. He can't put down the revolt. He has to live the remainder of his life in exile. And he wanders through Europe, visiting old battlefields of the Grand Armée. He eventually settles in Venice, Italy, where kids would point to him and say, "There goes the man that betrayed Napoleon." I know.
That's the legacy right there, isn't it?
Yeah, like he just made poor decisions. He also got divorced right after Napoleon's downfall. So he had a rough go of it. Now, some other marshals actually had a good go of it after Napoleon's final exile to St. Helena. One of them, Marshal Bernadotte, who I mentioned earlier, he was offered the king of Sweden, the throne there, and he ruled successfully Sweden for several decades and kept Sweden out of European wars, and his lineage is still on the throne of Sweden today. So Marshal Bernadotte did very well after Napoleon's downfall. One other guy was Marshal Soult, who became Prime Minister of France and Marshal General of France, a very lofty title that has been bestowed on only six people in all of history. So Marshal Soult really navigated post-Napoleonic France very well.
Yeah. And how do these guys kind of, because if you're going to be in charge of armies, you're going to be prime ministers, you're going to end up coming face-to-face in a setting with the dignitaries that you fought against, aren't you? How does that kind of politics work post the war? Because we never hear anything about the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah. I mean, a few marshals were put to death. Marshal Ney was killed by firing squad by the returning Bourbons of France. Marshal Murat was killed by firing squad by the Bourbons in Italy. So some of them met awful endings. Marshal Brune was killed by a mob, a royalist mob, right after Napoleon's loss at Waterloo. And Marshal Mortier died of an assassination attempt against the King of France, like in 1835. So several of them died violent deaths. Interestingly enough, you mentioned dignitaries. I think it was in 1838, Marshal Soult was a representative of France who was sent to London for the coronation of Queen Victoria. Big event, as you know, in English history. While he's there, he's walking through the music room and he's meeting with other dignitaries, and somebody grabs his arm. And it happens to be the Duke of Wellington, who says, quote, "I have you at last," end quote. And I just think that of all the conversations I could be a fly on the wall for, that would be the most interesting one. Because those two, as you mentioned, you know, they fought violently against each other for many, many years. And so to be like, you know, 23 years later in like a beautiful palace, just, you know, retired and living their best life, it must have been a very, very interesting conversation to hear those two adversaries meet cordially and talk about the old days.
And we have no records of what went on there other than that.
No, just that one quote from Wellington, which was great, because he did. He beat Soult in every battle, but he can never quite capture Soult in his army. He always escaped to fight another day.
It's got Nemesis written all over it, is that really, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a great little story. But yeah, you're right. After so many, decades of battle, to see these dignitaries meeting each other, you know, later on in life, that would have been very interesting.
Yeah, well, suppose at that point, like by that point, you know, Wellington's then approaching his career in politics himself. You've got to go from being a soldier to a politician at that point, really, haven't you? Which does require holding your nose and dealing with a few people you'd rather not.
Yeah, and you know, politics and warfare, you know, as Wellington probably learned, you know, they're two different animals. The great U.S. General Grant, you know, he became president after the Civil War. And he didn't fare too well in his two presidencies. And from what I understand, the Duke of Wellington didn't do that great of a job as PM himself.
No, I'm led to believe that. He's not our most effective prime minister, although compared to the crop of politicians that we get throughout the modern period, we can bring him back.
Fair point.
So it's often said that history is written by the winners, but I have to say Napoleon's history does appear to have been written by the loser.
Yeah.
So do you think Napoleon's generals have been overlooked in popular history just due to Napoleon's own prominence?
100%.
Why is Napoleon getting all the credit?
I think it's just his story, you know, coming from nothing, which, you know, he wasn't nothing. He was minor nobility on Corsica, but I mean, that was just a recently acquired territory for France. It was this tiny little island. To come from nothing and to basically dominate all of France and Europe, I think that's where the allure comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever there's a book written, and more books have been written on him than anyone else in history other than Jesus Christ, but how many of these books are focused on the marshals and generals? Very few. And that's why I started my little podcast, which I'm thrilled to say recently hit 50,000 downloads.
Hey!
Yeah, I know.
It's a magic number.
After that, it's really going to take off. I think his story is the more alluring and interesting one to general readers, and that's the one that sells books. Some of his marshals came from nobility, so they had a very easy access into reaching the general echelon. Some of them came from very poor families. Marshal Murat was an innkeeper's son. Marshal Ney, his father, was a cooper. He made barrels.
Mm-hmm.
Several others were farmers' sons. So Napoleon wasn't the only one to come from obscurity. But because he was in overall command of this, you know, invincible army for a decade, he gets all the publicity, and I think unfairly so. Because I think not only the generals and marshals, but, you know, the foot soldiers, you know, the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, you know, they should get more credit for Napoleon's success than they do.
I suppose as well, if you've, one of the troubles with exiling him to Elba and then St. Helena is that he could do nothing except write his memoirs.
Yeah.
And there's not going to be anybody there to tell him, you want to lay off now, or, you know.
Yeah. And you're right. He knew how to do, you know, he knew how to win in the court of public opinion. He was very good with marketing. He knew how to make his image almost godlike with the great artwork of the era, you know, him riding a horse over the Alps, you know, in a glorious uniform, you know, or his bulletins, where he would, you know, list the accomplishments of his Grand Armée throughout Europe. You know, those, he really knew marketing before the term marketing was around, and he knew how to publicize his great victories over his adversaries.
So, what would you like to see done to increase the profile of the generals, the marshals, the rest of the Grand Armée?
Great question. I would like more research and more, you know, investment done on their lives and their backgrounds and their battles. I mean, all these marshals wrote, you know, reports. All these marshals had victories that they touted in their bulletins to Napoleon. So I wish there was more books and research and literature out on how they did in battle and what their private lives were like. You know, many of them were family men. Many of them had, you know, brothers and sisters and parents that we really don't know a whole lot about. So I just wish there was more, I guess, scholarly research on their backgrounds, in addition to, you know, the everyman foot soldier of Napoleon's armies, because they did some truly amazing things. Now, Napoleon was a very inspiring leader, and, you know, he pushed them to do great things, but, you know, one man can't do everything by himself, and I think his officers and soldiers should get more credit for his accomplishments.
Well, thank you very much then, John. You absolutely missed a trick there. You could have answered that last question with, listen to the Generals and Napoleon podcast.
I thought about that. I was like, yeah, that's the easy answer. But
I will plug History Rage on everybody else's podcast, so you dive right in.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. If you'd like to know more about this subject, dear Ragers, then you can and should check out the Generals and Napoleon podcast. There you'll hear many guests, a few of our old History Rage alumni, and you'll find that wherever you can get your podcasts. So wherever you found us, you can find John. And you can follow it on Twitter @AndNapoleon. But once again, John, thank you very much for bringing the Rage on behalf of the Revolutionary Army.
Oh, my pleasure, Paul. This was fantastic. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope your listeners enjoy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave with us on Apple, Podchaser, or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel, and Kyle is at Kyle G History. And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/historyrage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.